Good morning again. So I came across a commentary, a small article in Tricycle Magazine a couple of weeks ago that really spoke to me and caught my curiosity. And it's it was a commentary on a new book from a scholar whose name is Peter Skilling. And Peter Skilling has a new book out called Questioning the Buddha, a selection of 25 sutras. And I'm waiting to receive the book because I'm very curious about it. And in this article in Tricycle, what was highlighted is one little piece from the book of a little known teaching from the Buddha that apparently it was, recently discovered, this four-line pithy teaching that I want to share with you, and we'll work through it a little bit today. And it was, the picture of it was, looked like it was on a piece of parchment and written in Pali. And it said that the Buddha said that there are four teachings that bodhisattvas should practice as long as they live. And remember that bodhisattva is us, one who dedicates themselves to act for the well-being of others. And even though we might think we're acting for the well-being of ourselves, it goes way beyond ourselves. So bodhisattvas, four teachings that bodhisattvas should connect to, should practice as long as they live. The first one, a bodhisattva should cultivate an aspiration for awakening as long as they live. A bodhisattva should maintain spiritual friendships as long as they live. A bodhisattva should practice patience, openness, and kindness as long as they live. Bodhisattvas should spend some portion of time dwelling in the wilderness as long as they live. So we're going to take this apart today. And these are, you could think of this as an aspiration, a vow, or a goal. And I think there's a difference when I think about taking on these teachings. One should, to begin with, that word, maybe that causes a little bit of ick in the mind for you right there about should. But we can take it as a serious prescription. I think the Buddha meant it that way. This is what we could do, but he's actually saying this is what we should do to cultivate awakening, spiritual friendships, patience and openness and kindness, and time in the wilderness, which maybe literally, we'll talk more about that, but wilderness meaning that sacred, unperturbed place that we can go in our own minds and hearts in our meditation. That's one way to think about it for this. So it's aspirational. Maybe it's a vow, maybe it's a goal. And I think that many ways our whole practice is a vow. And when I think about vowing, it's a commitment to go in a certain direction, just to keep going, knowing that we will lose our way, we'll get off the path here and there, but we can come back. And I remember when Norman Fisher once said, a vow is like moving towards the horizon. You can see it, it's way out there, and you go in that direction, but you can never get there. You can't get to the horizon, but you keep it in sight. This is the practice of sadha, of faith also, to place the heart upon. So these are vows that we can grow to trust. But as we think about bodhisattvas and what these teachings say, I want to give a little bit of historical context. And for me, I like looking at the historical context of our practice because it just gives more perspective. So from my understanding of this, Buddhism is divided into two main branches, the Hinayana and the Mahayana. So Hinayana is associated with the Theravada, Vipassana, insight meditation, you might say mindfulness meditation. It was an earlier form of practice that flourished around 250 BC. The teachings, it was in the language of Pali and mostly focused in down in India, Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Thailand, Cambodia, and Laos. And importantly, Gautama, the Buddha, was considered to be an ordinary person. He was an ordinary person who reached awakening through cultivating all these practices and studying his mind, studying the heart, studying his life. And in the Hinayana branch, the emphasis is more on the individual awakening through self-discipline, through study, through meditation. And so that might sound familiar because it's often how we, what is embedded in the teachings, especially in the Pali Canon, through Vipassana and insight meditation, the Theravada lineage. And then the Mahayana, which is associated with Vajrayana and Tibetan practice and Zen practice. And it was later than Theravada. It flourished more around 500 BC, and the language is in Sanskrit. And it was more in China, South Korea, Japan, and Tibet. So it went basically from the Hinayana started in India with the Buddha, and the diaspora was more south, and the Mahayana, the diaspora was more north. And the Buddha was considered to be a divine being who will help his followers attain nirvana, as opposed to an ordinary man who figured it out. So there's a difference of how we relate to somebody who's ordinary or somebody who we place divinity upon. And then the Bodhisattva role came about more in Mahayana practice, which is the dedication to ending suffering for all beings. It's less self-referential. But I think that we use that word Bodhisattva interchangeably. You know, we can call ourselves bodhisattvas when we take the precepts and say we really commit to not causing harm. That's a bodhisattva vow. So we can come to this first piece, this first teaching that says bodhisattvas should cultivate an aspiration for awakening as long as they live. So awakening, you may have your own definition of awakening. The way I relate to it is the uprooting of greed and ill will and delusion, and not being caught over and over again in what causes suffering. So many moments of awakening, but it takes lifetimes. And it said the Buddha had many, many lifetimes to awaken. But there is a vow, there is a bodhisattva vow that one takes that is very similar to the precepts. And you can, this is how it goes. And there are many iterations of this. And this one is the one that is chanted at Upaya Zen Center, Roshi Joan Halifax's center in Santa Fe. And it goes like this. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The awakened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. So taking that word vow, that means I'm committing to go in that direction. That's how I relate to this. So creations are numberless. Sometimes that's also translated as beings are numberless. I vow to free them all. So in one way, this might sound absolutely impossible, an impossible vow. But it's important, I think, if you take this in, notice where you take it literally and where you don't. That this is aspirational. It's a way of orienting towards a commitment, towards non-harming, towards generosity, towards love. So when we say at the end of practice and we offer a dedication of merit, may all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering, this is what we're pointing to. my commitment to keep working this practice to be of benefit to all beings and myself. Delusions are inexhaustible. Well, it's said that ignorance of these three toxins is the hardest to uproot. Delusion and ignorance being the same thing. It's over and over and over again we get caught. I vow to transform them. Right, this is our practice of cultivating clarity and balance, removing the filters, the judgmental mind, the reactivity, so we can see clearly. Reality is boundless. This is the Dharma. You know, the definition of Dharma is reality, or the truth, the nature of things, the truth of impermanence, the truth of dukkha, the truth of karma or interconnection. And it is boundless. I vow to perceive it. Like every time we do this, what we're doing in this time together is studying. How do I understand my life? How do I understand what is happening? And every time you might have that intention or that deep feeling that says, I want to understand this. What a beautiful vow. What a beautiful aspiration. This is what this vow is saying. I vow to perceive it. I'm going to stick with it. And then lastly, the awakened way is unsurpassable. How can we do better than uprooting greed, ill will, and delusion, and working towards our well-being and decreasing suffering, both mine and yours? I think that's what is meant by the awakened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Again, I'm going to stick with it. So that's how I understand the Bodhisattva should cultivate the aspiration for awakening as long as they live. And this is an operative point, as long as they live. Don't stop, keep going. So that's the first one. The second one, Bodhisattvas should maintain spiritual friendship as long as they live. When we take refuge in the Sangha and we show up together every single time, year after year, that many of us have been doing, and if you are new to Spirit Rock, welcome. I hope you keep coming back. If you come every once in a while, that's great. Keep coming back every once in a while as you can. But we need each other. Spiritual friends create the community in which awakening is possible because we feel connected. We know that we belong. We are supported and nurtured. So never doubt the value of showing up together. Never doubt it. The third one, Bodhisattvas should practice patience, openness, and kindness as long as they live. We're going to talk a lot about this after the meditation today, the parami of patience. But woven into patience, openness is the mindfulness, curiosity, willingness, and kindness, of course, metta and compassion. So this ability to abide the patience, to be with whatever is happening. There is no end to the importance of abiding and cultivating awareness and cultivating this kind heart for as long as we live. And lastly, Bodhisattvas should spend some portion of time dwelling in the wilderness as long as we live. The vital importance of taking time to cultivate the mind and heart in some sort of quiet way, whether it is a sitting practice, whether it's a walking practice, whether it is being in nature practice. And I know that, you know, we have to be careful about, I think, not taking some of this language so literally, but wilderness can mean the wilderness. It can be out in nature. It's not practical for everybody. And so if it's not practical for you, it might be that you just go outside. Or when you go from your car into the grocery store, noticing the experience of being outside. Or do you have a plant in your room? Or are you somewhere where you can't even have a plant, but maybe you have a picture of nature? So this way we don't get too granular about what it means, like to in no way say, well, that doesn't apply to me. I don't have access to nature. I don't have access to the wilderness. But you do hopefully have access to your inner landscape, your inner wilderness, that place that is yours, that can be private and sacred, that's there for you. So not doubting the value of quiet time for yourself. So these are four: awakening, sangha, patience and kindness, and quiet. So I love these four teachings, and I'm waiting for the book to arrive because I really want to dig in deeper into this scholar's work. So let's move into our meditation now, and we will sit for about a half an hour. So please find a posture that works well for you in your body, whether you're seated or standing, reclining. You may even choose to do walking meditation today. All four postures are of equal value. So once again, dropping the awareness inward, turning the awareness inward into this vast inner landscape, this wilderness that is in here. I'm reminded that Ross Gay says, "What happens if my wilderness meets your wilderness?" And in that we can be held. This is Sangha. So eyes open or closed, whichever you prefer. Sensing the touch points of the body, touching the furniture, the floor or the earth, the body even touching itself. Becoming aware of the breathing, the movement of the breath, the inhale and the exhale. The motion the body makes naturally in response to the breath cycle, an expansion and a relaxing back. So coming into this time with a quality of openness and kindness towards yourself, towards practice, knowing you're supported with so many others practicing in this moment. Being right here, listening, attending, being present. Inviting the heart to be with you. And when the mind drifts off, coming back, beginning again, over and over again, right where you place your attention, wherever that is, breath or body, or even your metta practice. And as the mind settles, the body relaxes, trusting this unfolding, being here. And then relaxing, maybe even a sense of gratitude for practice today, just as it is. We'll sit quietly. If you're noticing any holding, maybe the jaw has grown tight, or the shoulders have come up, maybe the chest or belly are holding, see if you can release. Maybe even just gently lift the shoulders to the ears and gently float them back down with an exhale, releasing anything that can be let go to make a little more space in the mind and body and heart. And noticing any stillness, comfort, maybe even ease or peace that may be present for you anywhere inside. And let that be in the forefront of your awareness, ease or peace, comfort or stillness. Being with that in any way that makes sense for you. Sensing into your own heart space now, however you sense it, maybe placing a hand on the chest to feel the warmth of your own body, hand to heart. Just sensing in, being with your own heart, your own goodness and goodwill. Moving into this practice of the heart's breath, if you like, imagining drawing fresh energy, fresh breath into the heart space from every direction, the back and the front of the heart, above and below, the sides and diagonals, drawing in this energy from all around you. Nurturing the heart, feeding it. And as you exhale, sending the energy back out into every direction. And the heart softens, is buoyed, becomes a little more spacious. Inhale, nurturing the heart. Exhaling, the heart relaxes. Give that a try for a few rounds if you like. And bringing to mind, if there's a vow that you have that holds your heart, that is a refuge for you, let that arise quite naturally. Don't work too hard. Just see what comes if you ask yourself, do I have a vow that is a guide? I want to offer you a very famous Shantideva prayer. Shantideva, the 8th century Indian Buddhist monk. May I become at all times, both now and forever, a protector of those without protection, a guide for those who have lost their way, a ship for those with oceans to cross, a bridge for those with rivers to cross, a sanctuary for those in danger, a lamp for those without light, a place of refuge for those who lack shelter, and a servant to all in need, for as long as space endures, and for as long as living beings remain. Until then, may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. Shantideva. All right, so just taking in the joys and the sorrows that are true, and they're everywhere. Let's take 5 minutes and see you at 9 minutes after the hour. Take a break. Thank you. Welcome back. Okay. So before we dive into the talk, I like to pause right here and check in with you on any questions that you might have from anything that I said earlier or anything that came up in the meditation that you would like to bring in. And you can just make yourself known and Carlita will unmute you. It's just a nice way midway through our time together to connect. Any questions or reflections? Diane, please. Yeah, I see you.
There we go.
There we go. Yeah.
Okay. I was just thinking, I'm in a challenging place in my life at the moment, and I was thinking about how it is so natural and easy to direct metta to other people, and how difficult it is for me at this point in time to direct that towards myself. And I'm wondering your thoughts on whether it truly is giving other people metta if you haven't held that for yourself yet. I think it's great to have good thoughts, and I think I'm doing this practice and I continue to do that, but I just always wonder about that disjoint. Am I truly being compassionate for other people if I have not accepted that compassion for myself?
What's your sense of it?
Yes, but I think it's a value for putting out the beautiful energies. I also feel like the fact that I'm putting out those beautiful energies reflects back that I have some of that for myself. I'm just not feeling it for myself. And sometimes I honestly feel like a little bit of a charlatan of saying that I'm doing that if I can't do it for myself all the time.
So beautifully put. And I think that you have a lot of good company with this. And I really appreciate that distinction and that sense, am I being a charlatan? I have many things I want to offer on that, on this, but I want to start with that last comment first. Am I being a charlatan? Because what came to mind is a piece that Jack Kornfield wrote in one of his books about this topic. And what he says is, just go through your day as if you're the Dalai Lama undercover.
I like that.
Isn't that great?
That is.
Because why not? Right? And that's not fake it till you make it. It's really not that. But what it is that place of embodying what would it be like to have that kind of boundless compassion. So a practice that can be helpful within metta to start sensing it for yourself, literally sensing it. So it's not conceptual. So this is an important place to shift from the conceptual mind to the felt sense, the embodied practice. When you offer metta for somebody else, there is a form of metta practice called radiating metta. And radiating metta drops down into the body and imagines, so this is a visualization. Does visualization work for you, Diane?
Very well.
Okay. So let's just try this. So if you imagine a being, human or non, let's say it's a, you know, it could be a pet, it could be a person, it could be whatever, and you are beaming from your heart to theirs, radiating this goodwill, this wish for their well-being, and it reaches them. And if you can sense that out of your own heart and visualizing maybe a beam of light, warm, sparkly light, whatever color you want, you can make this anything you want, and it reaches that other person's heart and fills them and surrounds them. Right in that moment of doing it, of beaming, radiating metta, if you can sense what that might feel like, right there, what that is doing is telling your own being, your own nervous system, your own essence, what it's like to feel that goodwill. Because you're doing it in a wordless place. And oftentimes, when words aren't included, it goes a little deeper because it gets you out of the head, mm-hmm. out of the repetition of may you feel safe and protected, may your suffering be eased. As powerful as that is, if you feel that disconnect of, okay, well, that's for somebody else, but I'm not included in it. When you do this body-based practice, you are automatically included. You can't separate from your own body. You know, when you get that feeling of radiating out, that's happening. So how can you not be that?
Right.
Do you follow me on that?
Right.
And so that way you are more than inclining, you're immersing. It's sort of a marinating. I like a marinade, like, oh, it's already there. It's already here. If you can offer metta to another person, metta is already inside of you. And so then the practice is to let yourself feel it instead of say it.
I think that's so important, the difference. I've been practicing for 30 years and I have normally felt that way. I've normally been able to do that for myself. And I think I've been just so much in my head.
Yeah.
And then I get the judgy, angry
voice
of myself.
Yeah.
So when you were talking, when you were reading the beautiful story about every day, when you just kept the refrain was every day.
Yeah.
And I get angry at myself for like having lost it.
Okay. So let's do one more thing and then we're going to move on. So here's another way. When you said, I've been practicing for 30 years and I used to do this and I don't have access to it anymore. There or right now, let's not say anymore.
Right
now.
In this moment.
For this moment. A part of a way of working with difficult times is to do something called resourcing. And resourcing is pulling back the experience of well-being, remembering, bringing to mind when you said, I used to be able to do that. I've been doing this for 30 years. If you can bring back to your present moment experience what it felt like when you used to be able to do it, that's another way of reminding your whole being, oh yeah, this is what it's like. This is what it's like. You're giving yourself the medicine that you need.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're so welcome. You're so welcome. One more. We're time for one more. Oh my goodness. Okay, we're definitely not getting to the whole Dharma talk today, but this is important. This is the best, actually, when we talk with each other. It doesn't matter what else I wrote down to say. Anybody else? Okay, then let's jump in. So if we take, let's go back and take these four teachings, and I'll repeat them once more, and then we're going to carry on here. Bodhisattvas should cultivate an aspiration for awakening as long as they live. Bodhisattvas should maintain spiritual friendships for as long as they live. Bodhisattvas should practice patience, openness, and kindness for as long as they live. And bodhisattvas should spend some portion of time dwelling in the wilderness for as long as they live. So let's focus on this third one of patience, cultivating patience, openness, and kindness for as long as you live. This is one of the paramis, the perfections of the heart, this aspect of the heart that helps support us in every other way. One way to think about patience is abiding. I think that's my favorite way of thinking about it, this being with. So pause for a moment, or even just think about this as I'm talking. When you think about patience, what does that feel like in your body? Just notice. See what you feel. Okay, that's just for you. Just to notice how that feels. It may be anywhere from some constriction to a total relaxation, somewhere along that line. So I think about cultivating patience as a way to move from resistance and rejection to an allowing and abiding. It's a practice of the heart. It's truly a courageous practice to be with whatever is happening right now. Many times we use in this practice the adage that right now it's like this. Right now it's like this. It's really about non-contention. Or as Longfellow said, for after all, the best thing one can do when it's raining is to let it rain. The best thing that one can do when it's raining is to let it rain. Because what a ridiculous thing it is to be in contention with the weather, right? I mean, that feeling of wanting it to be other, we can do that so easily with whatever the weather is. But more seriously, Suzuki Roshi, founder of San Francisco Zen Center, author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, what he says about patience, he said, maybe constancy is a better word than patience. The problem with patience, he says, is that you must force yourself to be patient. But in constancy, there's no particular effort involved. There's only, get this, the unchanging ability to accept things as they are. That's not easy, right? To cultivate the unchanging ability to accept things as they are. And what he went on to say is that patience can actually be a form of non-acceptance. So that place of, do we actually have to force ourselves to be patient, or can we open up to this quality of constancy, of abiding, the unchanging ability to be with things as they are? Here's a little more thought on what patience is and how it can work. And this comes from Ajahn Suchito. Ajahn Suchito is a Theravadan Buddhist monk. He says, patience is the kind of acceptance that acknowledges the presence of something without adding anything to it or covering it up. Says this is what's here. It's supported by the insight that when one's mind stops fidgeting, whining, and blaming, then suffering can be understood. Does your mind ever fidget or whine or complain? Mine does, right? And so right in there, there's all this non-patience, whatever we want to call it, impatience. Patience has the gut knowledge that recognizes that a problem or a pain is not something to run away from, get flustered by, or be self-pitying about. It has the wisdom to know that we have to prioritize the steps through which we can resolve suffering. I really love that. That means we're not really stuck. We can have a pity party, 5 minutes, right? Like something really hard happens. Okay, feel sorry for yourself for a few minutes because it's a bummer. That's the truth too. But patience has the gut knowledge that recognizes that a problem or a pain isn't something we need to run away from, get flustered by, or even be self-pitying about. But it has the wisdom to know that we have to prioritize the steps we need to resolve the suffering. And when we can go step by step with anything, it's easier, right? We just go bit by bit. What do I need to do? Just take the next step. You know, sometimes these compass questions can be something like, what is the next kindest thing to do, right? That's about prioritizing. What is the next right thing to do? That could be a harder question. So I mentioned earlier in our shared metta that my mom recently fell and fractured a minor fracture at the top of her femur. But she has been in a rehab center now for weeks. And every morning when she calls me at 7 o'clock or I call her, she starts with, I have got to get out of here. I have got to get me out of here. And I finally said to her the other day, Mom, I know you need to get out of there, but you're doing it step by step, literally, because she's regaining her walking. And I actually said, and it's really not helpful. It's really hard when we start the conversation with you telling me to get me out of here because I can't. And so can we just pull this back a bit and let's just go step by step and let's not start with the end goal of I have to get out of here. You will go home. So how do we use that? You know, when we have something that happens and it feels so unmanageable or so not what we want, can we have the wisdom to prioritize the steps? And Ajahn Suchito goes on to say, the specific quality of patience is to carry the heart through the turbulence of existence. Isn't that a great way to talk about dukkha? The turbulence of existence, so that it no longer shakes, sinks, or lashes out, right? We don't have to be controlled by this dukkha to bat us around. It's the restraint of holding the heart still in the presence of its suffering until it lets go of the ways in which it creates the suffering. Another piece of constancy, of patience. This is a really important piece. Patience is the restraint, so that's part of renunciation, of holding the heart still in the presence of its suffering, the abiding. Can we be with this suffering until it lets go of the ways in which it creates that suffering? So every time my mom says, I got to get out of here, That's tightening. That's creating more suffering out of an already difficult experience. When the heart can abide, the ways in which we make things worse for ourselves start to loosen up. And the last piece that I love so much on this, Ajahn Suchito says, patience has the soft and heartful strength of having all the time in the world. Can you imagine that? The heartful strength of having all the time in the world to rest in an experience. And then he says, patience relaxes the edge of time. Patience relaxes the edge of time. And this transformative power of patience is such that as the mind relaxes its defensiveness and bristling and annoying, and the annoying delay becomes an occasion for spaciousness. So imagine standing in the grocery store checkout line at 5 o'clock and you have two items. And the person in front of you all of a sudden has a bunch of stuff they need and you just want to get home and make dinner. If you can be in that moment of, okay, I'm in the grocery line right now, and I'm giving you a very everyday example so we can take this out of some lofty concept into why this works, why this matters. And we can say right now, all right, I'm in the grocery line, I'm not going to get home as fast as I wanted to. It relaxes the edge of time right there. And it becomes an occasion, an opportunity for spaciousness. So when we relax that edge and we become more spacious, there's a constancy, more ability to be with things as they are, which is why I think that this teaching, bodhisattvas should practice patience as long as they live, as long as we live, is because it makes way for openness, spaciousness, which makes space for the mindfulness, the loving awareness, the kindness to be present. And inherent in this is the truth of impermanence. It's not always going to be like this. The person in front of the line is going to go through. You're going to get there. However it is now, it is going to change. It will change. And within that moment, you know, within those times when we're stuck and we feel that I have to force myself to be patient, the annoyance, the bristling, the complaining, that's where we can see how these eight vicissitudes, these eight worldly winds blow through, right? Praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and shame, all of it, like all the ways that we can see what is positive and all the things that blow through that are uncomfortable. It's just how it is. And we can make it worse than it is through all of the blaming and complaining and rejection and resistance that happens about, I don't want it to be like this, instead of, it actually is like this. Okay, it's not going to be like this forever. Thich Nhat Hanh says, each moment is a chance for us to make peace with the world. You know, it's just so beautiful. Each moment is a chance for us to make peace with the world. Yeah, I don't want to make rancor, because when I make rancor, it's harder on me. But if my intention, so we can come back to these vows, that says, may I be at ease, or may I show up in the world in a way that creates more well-being and less suffering, it just makes so much sense, so logical. It's actually one of the things that I think really has kept me in this practice from the very beginning, when I started in earnest being in this practice about 20 years ago. It just makes so much sense. And that is what I love about it. I don't think it's full of magical thinking. The truth of dukkha, the truth of impermanence, that everything is connected, and that I can make more trouble than the trouble actually is, right? All of my opinions about everything can make things more difficult. From the Dalai Lama, he says, as destructive force there is nothing as strong as anger. Now, he's talking about the kind of anger that causes harm, not the kind of anger that can create transformation and positive change. So as a destructive force, there is nothing as strong as anger. An instant of anger can destroy all the positive actions. Indeed, there's no fault as serious as anger. Patience, on the other hand, as a discipline that neutralizes and prevents us from succumbing to anger, is unrivaled. Through it, the suffering we endure from the heat of the negative emotions is relieved. It's therefore of the utmost importance that we resolve to practice patience, gaining inspiration through reflecting on its advantages and on the terrible effects of anger. And from Shantideva, in his book, The Way of the Bodhisattva, Shantideva says, all the good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such as deeds of generosity and offerings to the Buddhas, a single flash of anger shatters them. No evil is there similar to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. Steep yourself, therefore, in patience in various ways, insistently. And this goes back to the teaching, practice patience your whole life. So then Shantideva goes on to say, this is how we can work with it in an outer way and then an inner way. So what he says about outward action, when feelings of desire or craving arise, or the urge to speak or act out of aggression arises, do not act. Right, so that takes discipline and patience and a resolve not to cause harm. And on the inside, see what happens when you don't act or you don't speak. Do those 8 winds come blowing through? You know, all the stories we tell us, okay, something may have really upset you and you may be feeling that anger. And then, you know, we've got the whole thing. He said, she said, shouldn't have happened, this happened, da 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 da. That's what happens in the reactive mind. But when you can see, oh, look at that reactive mind, how these winds blow through, how impermanence is true, it's going to change. This is what Shantideva says we should do. When the mind is wild with mockery and filled with pride and haughty arrogance, and when you want to show the hidden faults of others, to bring up old dissensions or to act deceitfully, and when you want to fish for praise or criticize and spoil another's name or use harsh language sparring for a fight, it is then that like a log you should remain. Don't do it. Don't do it. And that is hard, right? Can we tolerate the discomfort of this moment right now? What is the truth of this moment? And then we get into truthfulness, which is the next parami. But it is difficult to feel pain. It is very hard to be with whatever is here. And this is where patience then becomes something that we might force ourselves, but through our practice, we start training in, right now it's like this. Can I relax the edges of time, the demand that it should be other? Is there any amount of spaciousness right here? And that's a key question. Where is there a little bit of spaciousness right now? Here's a poem I want to share with you that I love. It's a little bit longish, and it speaks to this. This is called The Facts of Life by Padraig O Tuama. And if you're familiar with Padraig O Tuama, he is a brilliant Irish poet, a man who has done a tremendous amount of work in conflict resolution. And he's maybe 50. He's done a lot of work on the On Being podcast with Krista Tippett. He has a piece of that called Poetry Unbound, which is beautiful. Every week he reads another poem. And anyway, he's a beautiful writer. The facts of life. That you were born and you will die. That you will sometimes love enough and sometimes not. That you will lie if only to yourself. That you will get tired. that you will learn most from the situations you did not choose, that there will be some things that move you more than you can say, that you will live and that you must be loved, that you will avoid questions most urgently in need of your attention, that you began as the fusion of a sperm and an egg of two people who once were strangers and may well still be, that life isn't fair, that life is sometimes good and sometimes better than good, that life is often not so good, that life is real, and if you can survive it well with love and art and meaning given where meaning's scarce. That you will learn to live with regret, that you will learn to live with respect, that the structures that constrict you may not be permanently constricting, that you will probably be okay, that you must accept change before you die, but you will die anyway. So you might as well live, and you might as well love. You might as well love. You might as well love. Isn't that gorgeous? There's so much truthfulness in this, and it is all about this is how it is. And within this is how it is, how do we find our way with love? Truly, how do we find our way with love? So I'm going to stop there. And let's talk with each other.